Welcome to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cirelli. I've got a dear friend, and usually outside of a select few, I don't have people I'm very close with on the podcast. This individual, Dr. Chris Free, I've known since 2016 when...
15?
Okay.
I was trying to remember earlier myself.
Brain trauma. Long ago, but... Chris came along at the bequest of a friend while I was going through some rough times. Chris has dedicated a good portion of his life without any asking anything in return to really my genre of guys, my brotherhood, former special operators from the United States Special Operations Command who are having difficulty transitioning out of the military in dealing with the plethora of shit that we went through, both physiologically and psychologically. And he was there. And I remember we used to jump on the phone at least once a week for, seemed like sometimes it was 1 hour to 3 hours, taking up his time. And again, you didn't ask for anything in return. And quite frankly, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. And I also got to say Jordan, because it was just right timing to bring a good woman in my life who gave me the proverbial slap and said, hey, get your shit together or this isn't moving forward. So it was a combination of you two. But really proud. The operator syndrome is dropping March 26th. This is, what would you say, a decade or more?
Yeah, about a decade.
About a decade of research into U.S. Special Operations soldiers, which the reason this is unique is that Special Operations were at the forefront of the war for 20 years. Constant repeat deployments. And so they were amongst the most deployed troops.
Training evolutions.
We train hard. As the saying goes, the more you bleed in training, the less you bleed in war. That is a mantra that is adhered to within special operations. It's understood. And so sometimes there's more booms in training than there is in combat, which ultimately where I'm leading with that is the traumatic brain injury that comes along with being that close to explosives. But Chris, thanks for joining us. And would love if you would just give a brief background of your history and then dive into operator syndrome, first defining what is the operator syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, thanks, Mike. That was a really gracious introduction, and I'm honored and privileged to be here, and whatever I've done for the community has come back to me, you know, tenfold. So I'm a clinical psychologist by training, still even hold a license in South Carolina. I don't do any traditional clinical practice anymore. I haven't in a long time, but I spent 15 years working in a PTSD clinic in the VA system, 92 to 2006. And I've continued on working with veterans ever since, the last decade almost entirely with special operations, including not just American forces across every branch, including active duty and no longer active duty, but also Canadian, and the Canadian community is now tuning in, and we're getting a little more involved with some of our friends up there. And as you know, largely due to your introductions and connections. Also, I do a lot of work now with responders, and you know, I think we can draw a real clear parallel between special operations and what law enforcement, EMT, firefighters do, you know, every day of the week, and with very little appreciation, very little awareness for the types of injuries and experiences that they have. I have a traditional clinical background. I was a therapist in the VA for 15 years, but I also have an academic career. So I have had lots of grants, over 300 scientific publications. Really the last decade though, I've just been learning, talking to hundreds of guys and gals, operators, spouses, children even in a few cases, and just trying to learn and understand. I've talked with a lot of the care providers from within the community, the doctors, nurses, psychologists, psychiatrists, neurologists, occupational therapists, nutritionists.
Endocrinologists.
Yeah, and more. I mean, going to leave somebody out for sure, but yeah. So it's been a learning, a high learning, steep learning curve for me, because initially we have some friends in common. Now, I won't name names, but early on I was thinking, oh, PTSD expertise. This will be the ticket to help some of my friends. And as we got into our conversations, what I realized is it's not PTSD is not the primary issue for the community. It's other things. And that's not to say PTSD isn't part of the picture, but it's not the primary. It's not even anywhere near the top of the list. I don't see the fear reactivity that you expect that is the core component of PTSD. The fear reactivity.
World War I shell shock?
Well, the idea of PTSD, one of the core components is it's an anxiety disorder where people have anxiety specific to their traumatic exposures, and they avoid those things. I mean, you are still jumping out of airplanes. Most of the guys I know—
Not well. Let's make that clear. Not well. Yes, I jump out of airplanes, but—
But you have no fear of doing it. Or if you do have fear, you do it anyway, yeah. I guess. And so, there just isn't the fear reactivity to be able to call it PTSD. Now, the VA will push the PTSD button every time. Guarantee you an operator can go to the VA and say, I was in combat, I was in this type of unit, and boom, there's a PTSD diagnosis, whether you want it or not, probably. And what happens with that? A PTSD diagnosis is then followed very quickly by, here's your bowl of medications. Maybe it's a bucket.
Quite literally.
Yeah. Maybe it's a bucket. Mm-hmm. And here's your social worker or your therapist, your psychologist, whatever. And that's it. That's it.
It becomes a dependency of sorts.
It becomes a dependency, but worse than that, it's not the treatment that's needed. It's the wrong. It's treating the wrong condition, essentially. So what is operator syndrome? And I'm going to be, first, I would just want to say, I didn't invent the phrase. It was something that I had in my head at some point for a long time, way before we ever wrote a paper on it. And I guess just to say, the book is kind of a downstream product of a medical paper we published in 2020 titled Operator Syndrome, and where we describe—
Which was wildly in I guess, in our line of work, in our community, it went viral.
It did. It did the equivalent of going viral in the community. It hasn't been picked up by SOCOM or PT or the VA or—
SOCOM has not picked it up.
Not that I know of.
Interesting.
Most of the branches have, Naval Special Warfare. I've, gotten little trickles of from, top folks that there's some resistance or, as one admiral said to me, he's not enamored of the phrase, and we were going to have a conversation about it, but he wasn't able to make any of the subsequent meetings that we scheduled. So we never had the conversation. So what is operator syndrome? Let me speak to that, and I'll just kind of lay it out quickly, and then we can kind of get into the questions, some of the other topics that that I think go around the space. So the idea of operator syndrome, and it was an idea or a phrase that was kind of cooking in my mind for a while, but many other guys I met in the community, including care providers, amateur mistake here. many other care providers had the same term in their thoughts. Kirk Parsley, for example.
Yes.
You know. Kirk.
And he's been on the podcast multiple times.
He in his head, I think he was calling it SEAL syndrome. People that worked with Green Berets, kind of, so this phrase operator syndrome, I don't want to claim any credit for inventing it.
And just for everyone, when he's saying operator within special operations, if you're a Green Beret, a Navy SEAL, Air Force CCT, Air Force PJ, MARSOC Raider, they're referred to as operators.
And that's a formal definition.
Yes.
But I include the fast boat, the SWIC.
I'm leaving people out. Yep.
Well, Scout, no, you're snipers. Not. I'm just building. EOD, the explosive ordnance disposal. Yes. Ground pounding combatants.
Infantry
kicking in doors. And a lot of that urban close quarters combat. That causes many of the same injuries. One thing that's, just for the audience to understand, one thing that's really unique about most of special operations, including the enablers and everybody that works within the community, is the length of a service career. 10 years, 20 years, you don't see the 4-year enlistments that you see in conventional forces. But more than that, or in addition to that, on top of that, and it's not just the six deployments, the 12 deployments, the 800 missions, it's also the training, which is brutal and involves, I mean, how many evolutions of breaching and demolitions did you have in your career?
Can't count. And the breachers, the guys that actually, that was a defined role.
Right. You're not even a breacher and you had, you know, a massive. So what I would want people to understand is the dose, if I can use that word, of blast exposures, blast wave exposures. When there's an explosion, there's an invisible shock wave that goes out over pressure. That is a shearing effect. It goes through the body. It's not the same injury as an impact force. It can knock you down and cause that concussion, but it's a different type of injury. It goes through your brain. So we see different types of scarring patterns in the brain for blast exposures as compared to like the impact force injuries that football players and boxers and soccer players end up with. Of course, you have both. Most operators have both types of brain injuries. So let me just run down the list. And these are all interrelated. We can't separate them. That's part of the challenge is these all go together. I mean, your physical body, we refer to your endocrine system, your nervous system, your pulmonary system, your cardiac system, all systems, whole systems are being affected here. So TBI, cognitive impairments, headaches, hormonal dysregulation, primarily low testosterone. I mean, I think 80, 90% of the guys I work with have low testosterone by their mid-30s, maybe sooner. Then you have insomnia. You've got the sleep circadian disruption of sleep rhythms. Everybody seems to have sleep apnea, which you wouldn't expect.
I had it at 35.
At 35.
In the peak of my shape.
Yeah, the peak of your shape. Yeah, you were not an overweight middle-aged man, which is why that came as such a shock to me when I was first learning about the community. Then you got all the psychological things, depression being at the top of that list, depression, anger, general anxiety, like worry and an inability just to kind of turn down that arousal, that physiological arousal. Certainly some symptoms of PTSD, but you know, PTSD really is just a mixture, a combination of depression and anxiety.
Let's dissect it because we talked about this at length for post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, I think what most people think, and it may be the case for a lot of people with PTSD, is it's the trauma of combat. It's seeing the bodies, the mutilation.
That's the theory.
But as we worked together 2016 through 2019, when you're giving me your time, I think we came to the conclusion up front that I didn't mind the booms and the bangs. I didn't mind eliminating individuals that were just, you know, Islamic terrorist. In fact, that didn't bother me slightly. It was you classified it as your form of post-traumatic stress is the survivor's guilt.
Survivor's guilt, maybe some regret over things you didn't do or couldn't control. I don't know how much you want to get into some of your experiences, but just through, you know, chance, you were in a spot where some bad stuff happened and you were somebody else lost their life and you walked away from that moment. But
drawing a linkage with, you know, the guys I'm close with within the community, it seems to be that is the common thread for all of them.
Yep.
Didn't mind the combat. In fact,
A lot of guys miss it.
Because of the brotherhood and the bonds that are forged, but they are just distraught by the survivor's guilt that they didn't bring home their teammate.
Yeah. That's right. And then add on to that some of the other existential concerns, like who are you afterwards, after the career, after you take off the uniform? That loss of mission and purpose and tribe is just a—
like your DNA has been ripped out.
Yeah, it's so powerful. And then on top of everything else that we've just described, you've got the chronic pain in every joint in the body. I'm still waiting to meet a guy that doesn't have chronic pain in the shoulders, knees, ankles, hips, neck, elbows, wrists. What did I leave anything out there?
I've got a fake hip.
Probably some joints that don't even exist in the medical textbooks. Then you had you add addiction, because drink.
You got to replace that lack of combat with something.
You do, and also in the units and the teams, alcohol is kind of something of a competitive sport, and it's certainly part of the culture.
It's culture, yeah.
Yeah, it's culture. And if you don't drink, then your teammates are looking at you kind of sideways, wondering what's wrong with Mikey. And then you bring that home, and you have a family. Marital problems are widespread. I think the divorce rate is... Somebody told me once they thought it was 150%. I think it's more like...
Because guys get divorced more than once.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think it's probably more like 200, 250.
I'd heard the last unit I was with, it had a 95% divorce rate, and we're talking either marriages while you were there or first marriages fell through. But it wasn't always... It seemed like more of the guys left their wives than wives left the husbands.
Did it?
And I think it was because they got married young. And a lot of guys got married because a war had kicked off.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I'll say it for what it is. They didn't want to leave the earth without leaving a legacy behind.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then they wake up 10 years later and I'm like, and they're like, I don't even know this person.
Mm-hmm.
We are not the same. There's no common thread other than the children.
Mm-hmm.
And they.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then let's go to after you take the uniform off, things don't necessarily get easier at that point. I know plenty of marriages that survived the war, didn't survive the next year or two.
Yes.
And usually those marriages seem to be instituted by the spouse, by the wife.
Yes.
Suddenly.
And that's actually, I've seen that. You're right that regard.
Suddenly the operator's home, and who is he? What is he? The spouse has been home taking care of the children, managing the household. I mean, she's been a rock star all those years, and isn't prepared for what comes home, isn't prepared for the injuries, isn't prepared for the confusion about what it means to be a civilian now. It's really hard. And let's just acknowledge what the spouses go through and experience. While the operator is in his career, the spouse is doing all of that, but every deployment, planning your funeral and thinking that through, that takes a toll. That's heavy.
Yeah.
They're alone. They don't necessarily have an easy community around them, because how does the wife of a Green Beret or a SEAL or Marine Raider, who do they relate to when their husband's away? You know what I mean? It's kind of an isolated place to be in.
I don't want to say I can't empathize. It's so foreign to me to put myself in their boots, proverbial boots, of them staying home as we go, because we want to go forward.
Oh, yeah.
I do remember a story with my ex-wife when I got wounded in 06. All the wives were brought together,
mm-hmm.
and she felt like she said she felt like a cold sting of... I don't want to say jealousy is maybe not the right word, but other wives were cold to her because her husband was all of a sudden put into the limelight and theirs wasn't.
Mm.
And she said it was the strangest thing.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point,
mm-hmm.
we never really engaged with mm-hmm. other military families
mm-hmm.
with the barbecues or things along those lines, mm-hmm. unless they were very close friends.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because it's the wives network, as we called it, was in military families, it has its own group of politics and
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And it can work out really well. There can be a tight-knitness to that, but it can also not work out for everybody. And there isn't really an easy other place for spouses to go, in part because they can't even talk to other people. What did your husband do? Well, he's a soldier and he's in this kind of unit. Well, where's he? What's he doing? Well,
I don't know. I can't say.
I don't know. Yeah, they can't say. And then the children. Think about the children. I had a conversation with a good friend, mutual friend of ours, an adolescent, as a as an adolescent, probably 14 or 15, and going through some struggles. And one of the things that we talked about was he'd been to, I don't know, a dozen funerals of his uncles, brothers of his father, brothers in arms of his father. And he was often wondering, well, I wonder if my father's alive today, because he could have been killed 10 minutes ago and I just haven't heard yet. That was a thought that routinely went through. So, man, you talk about a heavy childhood and the weight of that on a child. Within operator syndrome, let me just, so we talked about the psychological, the physiological, the psychological, which there's no difference. I mean, the psychological is physiological. All of this is physiological, because if you have chronic pain, a traumatic brain injury, sleep apnea, low testosterone, all of that is physiological at the cellular, molecular level even, and it affects, you know, everything going on in your psyche. A few other things. Perceptual, you know, your perceptual systems are damaged. Vision, hearing, balance, impaired balance, hand-eye coordination is a common element of untreated traumatic brain injury. Some of that can be treated.
So that's why I'm so shitty at skydiving now. I was never good. I'm kidding with you.
Well, I didn't chuckle because you may be right. That probably does play a factor. Emotional intimacy is a big problem for a lot of guys. Mm. Just being able to be vulnerable, to be able to talk about their feelings, to be able to, really just connect and bond with their own family. I mean, how do you do that? For your children, you've missed a lot of milestones, birthdays, holidays. When you're home on active duty, you're training, your mind still is with your unit and your brothers. After retirement, you got to relearn. If you ever learned, you have to relearn. You have to learn that emotional, that ability to form those emotional ties that other humans expect. Sexual intimacy is a real problem. Every operator I've talked to, I don't want to say every, but a high percentage of operators with low testosterone struggle with sexual functioning. And I don't just mean erectile dysfunction, but I mean
the sex drive,
the desire, also kind of balancing the competitive need to rack up conquests with the need to have that connection with one person. So relationships really, you know, take a beating there.
And I think that to tie it back, I think one of the most common things I've heard about our guys, ladies have told me, to include my current wife, but have also told other guys, like, you're emotionally bereft.
Yeah.
There's no emotion.
There's sex, but there's not eye contact.
Yeah.
There's sex and maybe even excitement, but not that tenderness.
To what degree do you account that towards military training, where it's you've got to learn to compartmentalize or just shut off emotion,
right?
And it's just so hard to again, like a light switch, just flip back on.
And you can't do that with intimacy. You can't just turn it on and off.
But even beyond intimacy,
with
the lack of
emotional connection, right? Well, so you learn to compartmentalize because you have to. You don't have time in the middle of an operation to stop and mourn the soldier next to you who just died, who was just killed violently, brutally, horribly. And then you get off the mission. You don't have much time. Maybe there's time to kneel at a ramp ceremony for a few minutes. And then you're back in the team room spinning up for the next, whatever comes next.
Yeah.
And then when you get home, maybe you go to a funeral. How many funerals?
Too many.
Ballpark?
I think 20 plus. But remember too, when we're losing guys over there.
Oh, you don't have time.
It was a grace. I hate to, and I don't want people to think I'm sounding cruel. I thanked my lucky stars that I didn't have to go to the funeral for the guys we lost within our units. Cause I just didn't want to see the family. I didn't want to have to feel.
Right. So 20 plus, but there were another large number of funerals you didn't go to because you were deployed.
Didn't go to the Extortion 17.
Yeah.
Because I was forward deployed with that element. And what? That was 31.
31 guys.
31.
Well, 31 funerals you didn't go to.
Yeah. Like that.
Just like that. Like that. So you get to the end of the career and you have all of that on, you know, I'm not terribly psychodynamic. I'm not psychodynamic at all. But you don't have to be psychodynamic to think that there would be a period where suddenly things are quiet. Your life becomes quieter and now you can't escape those memories. And a lot of guys, there's a time where for the first time they're thinking about, you know, maybe deeply about the brothers they lost.
The pot boils
over. And I mean, you know, this is a little bit of a cliche, but how many numbers of dead men and sisters do you still have in your phone?
Yeah.
I have a few myself.
Yeah.
Can't bring myself to, you know, just delete them. It's hard. And
so it's almost like disrespectful in a way.
Yeah.
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 And there's one who passed in Yemen who I was texting with before he went on that deployment. He was going to come visit me in Austin. Mm-hmm. I still have that text.
You still have the text.
Yeah.
Or the voice. I know guys that have the voice messages.
Voicemails.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's hard. And then we have the whole thing called a transition into civilianhood. And you're kind of left with the message or given the message that you're supposed to take off the uniform and now become a civilian and assimilate. I don't know how you do that. Nobody does. How do you take off the warrior identity and exchange that for a civilian identity? And I think that's harder than people realize. I don't think it can be done, actually. I think if you're a BAMF, and you're a BAMF forever, and you have to do a little, you may have to pretend, you may have to try to soften some things. I'm sure you have friends and colleagues who are civilians who never served, like myself. But it's harder to connect with people. And let's face it, America is pretty damn fucking indifferent to the global war on terror. Most Americans don't know what happened. They don't know the history. Most don't know anybody who fought in the war. I mean, veterans are a very small percentage of the American population and they tend to run in families. So, I mean, you may have a family lineage of veterans. I teach college undergraduate students who are now, you know, typically 18 to 22. They don't even, they were born after 9/11. They barely know what 9/11 was. They don't know anything about the global war on terror. Many of them don't even know there has been a global war on terror.
You know, trust me, I see both sides of the coin on this one.
Yeah.
One, it's easier not to confront for them the harshness or the realities of the world. Yeah. Americans are pretty, there is entitlement, but there's also a major lack of perspective that they haven't been to Somalia, that they haven't been to Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria. Or Gaza, and they get to live in this very relatively safe first world country, and it's easier to tune into what is it, the Real Housewives of OC than it is to watch the news about segment about three soldiers being killed in Jordan from a drone, or five TF-160th pilots whose helicopter went into the Mediterranean and all of them passed. But what they never see, and we were just talking about this, is they never see how that impacts the wives, that somebody has to go to the door and knock on the door and say, ma'am, for you and your two children, your loved ones not coming home. It's easier for Americans to tune that out and watch reality TV.
Yep.
And I think I've come to be less angry about that. And again, I would say the right word is indifferent.
Yeah, indifferent. And I think we have an indifferent society in general. And a very ignorant society about what is happening in the wider world. Yeah, a lot of people can tell you what's happening on reality TV programs and the new influencers and Instagram and reality TV stars, but they don't know what's happening in China, Ukraine, Yemen, Somalia. We have guys, we have troops in contact all over the world on a regular basis. I work with a team that's flies in and out of very dangerous places in the world, and not covertly, overtly. They fly, they land a plane, they fill it up with people, and they bring them out to refugee centers or back to the U.S.
Yeah.
And nobody has a line of sight on that, which is a shame.
I want to jump into testosterone because TRT, testosterone replacement therapy, is now widely available to, mm-hmm. to all Americans. And the difference between why an individual who didn't serve in these combat environments has low T, I know it's lifestyle, health, mm-hmm. A lot of the processed foods, we're finding data that yeah. shows that's lowering testosterone. But specific to the operator syndrome, these guys are healthy. Yeah, we drank a lot, but we also ate pretty healthy. We were always working out.
Yep.
Their testosterone levels are coming down because of
lifestyle
or combat. So basically, I think you gave me sort of the layman terms on this. When we go to combat, our testosterone's at a certain level, and when you're in a combat theater, your testosterone starts to lower, your cortisol comes up. But when you return to the United States, there's a sort of rebalance.
There can be a rebalancing. Yeah, yeah.
Eventually, that rebalance stops.
Right. Well, and so why do you have low testosterone? It's probably related to several things. Traumatic brain injury, for one. Mm-hmm. I mean, your pituitary is on the receiving end of those shearing blast exposures. Pituitary being the master gland of the endocrine system. But you're also, your sleep is jacked up. And that's when testosterone is produced and regulated, is during sleep. So as long as your sleep is out of whack, my friend, it's going to be hard for your testosterone to recover. Now, the good news is not everybody with low T needs TRT replacement therapy. That would be considered, you know, not the first thing the experts would focus on, but they're, you know, dialing in the diet, the nutraceuticals, the sleep, maybe some short-term other types of medications to lower the estrogen, because that becomes another thing. It's not just that the testosterone goes down in men, the estrogen goes up. I spoke to a couple years ago, I had a surgeon at a VA, I don't remember which state, but she reached out to me and saying that she does a lot of breast reduction surgeries in former Rangers. They have gynecomastia from elevated estrogen, man boobs.
Which we see in people that overuse steroids.
That's a common thing too, right? Yeah.
Not saying Rangers are using steroids, but that's an interesting.
Why are you hating on Rangers?
Oh, I'm not. I said the Rangers Rangers are awesome, dude. I've always said that.
They are.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
So just by mere exposure to combat in lack of sleep and all these other things, gynecomastia is...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have all... So we've just talked about the bad news. Let's pivot to some good...
Before we talk about the good news and the recovery, why do you think there was such resistance from senior officers within SOCOM, as if we don't want our operators... And we've got to hold them accountable. That sort of pisses me off.
Well, I want to be really careful here because I don't have conversations with SOCOM. So I don't really know what the internal conversations are. I've had a few very, very limited conversations with flag officers at the Admiral General level. And some of them have been positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't, I won't put out names. But I know there are at least some admirals that have come to me and said, hey, I don't like this. I'm not enamored with this. But I don't know why. So let me maybe hypothesize some reasons. One is operator syndrome, as I refer to it and describe it, is a framework for understanding the complex and interrelated injuries. It's not a diagnosis itself. It's not a diagnosis. It's a stack of diagnoses that all seem to come together and occur interrelatedly for people who've had these types of exposures and injuries. It's intended to be a framework that can be used downstream of a career for understanding treatments and approaches to health and wellness. But it's also, and I use it this way, upstream, earlier in a career. I work with guys who are in their 20s. Late 20s, early 30s.
To get ahead of
some of these injuries.
I mean, it's not like you're advocating people not to be and serve long careers in special operations in the military or first responders.
No, I'm not advocating that. The guys I work with are going to do what they're going to do no matter what.
God bless them.
Yeah. Brave, courageous patriots. And that goes for the responders too.
Yes.
Firefighters and law enforcement, EMT, they live every day knowing that it could be their last day.
As well as exposed to probably more trauma on a per capita basis than we did over in the global war.
Perhaps. Yeah. And let's come back to responders because I don't want to give them short shrift. But what can you do? Well, you can do a lot of stuff with lifestyle, you know, limit the drinking, have a plan for, staying connected to your family. Mm. Sometimes it just takes some mindfulness and a plan for that. Really think carefully about your diet, what you're going to eat, what you're not going to eat. Just don't drink sodas or energy drinks. Don't eat fast food. Don't eat junk food. Don't eat sugar. You know, dial in on that. You know, that a lot goes there. Sleep. Be aware of your sleep. Be mindful about scheduling enough time in bed whenever you can. I know you can't always. But get the sleep and prioritize the sleep. I talked with a friend yesterday, had a good conversation with somebody who was at one of your old places. And a training evolution, you know, away from family on the other side of, but states on the on CONUS on the mainland. And, you know, everybody, all his buddies, all his brothers were going out some of the nights, you know, working all day. And
yeah, we partied pretty hard.
Partying a little hard. He didn't. He said he was proud of himself and I'm proud of him. He took those nights to sleep and to focus, doing some meditation, doing, you know, he's in getting more into deeply into his faith. But prioritizing his sleep and diet and using and making time every night to connect back home.
Yeah.
So important and hard because, hey, he's missing out on a great party. The party, you know, there were, I don't want to say literally rock stars, but there probably were at this, you know.
Some guys burned it down. They were very good at that.
NFL athletes.
I was always amazed.
Yeah.
They could burn it down until 3 a.m, be up at 6, ready to train. As I got older, that got a lot tougher to do.
Well, it does. It catches up with you.
Yeah.
It absolutely catches up with you. And so there's a lot everybody, you know, everybody in the community can do to at least mitigate some of these effects. One thing, you know, so then you get into, well, what can the military do differently? You know, and I don't, that's not my area of expertise. I'm not going to tell the military what they should do, and training, you know, has to happen. As you said, it's of utmost importance, but maybe there are downtimes that get built in differently from how it's being done now. Maybe there is, I don't know, 5% less of blast exposures. Again, I don't know. Air Force, I think Air Force is now looking at, they've got some projects going on where they're looking at a variety of strategies to mitigate operator syndrome, including use of MERT, which is a transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is FDA approved for depression. But they're looking, the MERT is a variation of that where they use EEG readings to give a more precise tuning to the TMS.
Air Force always, you know, we refer to, people think the military, you know, the F-22, all this great equipment, all this great technology, and we are technologically advanced as a military. But the greatest asset the military has is what we call the human weapon system. And I'm not surprised that the Air Force is sort of leading the charge because they've got a great research laboratory. They're pouring a lot of money into that. But ultimately for the fighter pilot, the PJ, the CCT, you know, you've got to get as much longevity out of them as possible. And that's, it's not surprising whatsoever.
So one way of thinking about operator syndrome is to think about the phrase allostatic load, A-L-L-O static. Allostatic load is a hypothetical construct of everything that's dumped on your shoulders. And that literally means everything. The psych, you know, the training, the injuries, the experiences, the exposures. And I even talked about that. I've got a chapter in the book on the toxic exposures, which cause respiratory illnesses and skyrocketing high rates of cancer.
What's the there's an organization, a nonprofit,
Hunter Seven. Yep.
Who especially is leading the charge with regards to the burn pits and all the cancer related.
And it's so much more than burn pits. I would say forget about the burn pits. That's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yep.
Radiologicals, biologicals, the chemicals in your uniforms that
the jammers
that bleed into your skin in the heat. Yeah. The jabs in the arm, the vaccinations, the anthrax, the radar, you know, aviators fly with the radar right there in their crotch, practically many of them. The aviation fuels that they're breathing all day. I mean, we didn't even mention aviators, the guys that fly the jets and the guys and gals. The G's, all the equipment in the cockpit has a, you know,
emissions.
You're just absorbing stuff. So I think we're gonna know more. If you're listening to this and you want to donate money to an organization, Hunter Seven, Chelsea Simone's organization, phenomenal work. They are really pushing the envelope on not just research, but also helping individuals.
Good.
And advocating on the Hill. So that's a phenomenal organization. Responders? Good. Responders? Talk about responders a little?
Go for it.
So I'm working with a career firefighter up in Canada, name's JD Miller, and she's kind of tuned into this whole operator syndrome idea about 4 years ago and reached out to me. Like you said, the paper went viral, mm-hmm. and she found it and she read it and was like, holy cow.
This is us.
This is us too.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't have the same exact experiences. They don't get the blast exposures, but they get other things. And sometimes they get blast exposures, you know, all the chemicals going into a structure fire where you don't even know what's in there. So cancer rates are really high, all the psychological stuff. A lot of them have hormonal dysregulation. We go right down the list. We've even written a few things about this, which you can find in an online magazine called Crackle. But then you get into the solutions and her idea, JD's idea, she formed this little company called Pyroc, which is just getting started. We've now gone through a couple of phases with Amazon Innovative, but the idea is to take all the data we can get, everything. So your wearable data, your medical data, some self-report data, uniform sensors, information and data on the nature of your training, on the nature of the calls.
Yes.
The nature of the 911, the radio signal traffic between fire trucks or the station. And this is a model we think can be used for law enforcement and military populations as well. Take all that data and you know, put it into the AI, you know, bot. And now I'm getting way ahead of myself because I don't understand any of this, but let AI start to figure it out so that you get a daily report, you know, that's more than just what you get from the wearable.
Yep.
So that your commander gets what they need, not all of the private personal stuff, but they get something that, and it might even be individual to you. It might be represent the entire unit that you're with or the team or the fire truck or the station or, you know, at whatever level. We're also tuning it into, I mean, part of the idea is to tune it into, you know, SOPs so that, you know, policies and procedures and training experiences are somehow dialed into this. And I'm now at the end of my knowledge, so I won't say anything more about it.
You were going to get to the good, the rehab.
Yes, yes. The good news. Let me take a moment to talk about my book.
Yeah.
So the book Operator Syndrome is, it's intended to be an easy read. You could read, you know, somebody who reads fast, much faster than I do, could read it on a 3-hour flight. It's also intended to be a practical, helpful guide for operators, responders, spouses, family members. It's not an academic book at all. I wanted it to be a page turner. Each chapter there's a chapter on each of the components. They're short chapters. They read like, you know, little online magazine articles. They each end with a, you know, here's some practical things you can do now today. Now that you've read this 5-page chapter, here's 3 things you could start to do today. That's kind of first part of the book. The second part of the book is about the treatments, the interventions, the lifestyle, habits and changes that can make a difference. And I want to just give a shout out to, you know, I don't know, I've probably talked to 400 or 500 soldiers, operators in the community and their spouses over the last decade. So I've learned from the community. Maybe I've helped a few people, but as much as anything, I've learned. And so this is a representation of what I've learned directly from you, your brothers and sisters. And throughout the book, every chapter starts with two or three or four quotes, direct quotes that people have given me with their, in 98% of the cases, their names and their unit numbers, unit designations. They're bona fides.
Yes.
So yes, I wrote the book, and if it sucks, that's on me. The inaccuracies, mistakes are on me, but the words in there, many of the words in there come directly from people that you know, lived experience. You know, we like to talk about lived experience these days. That seems to be a phrase. So much of this book is about lived experience. We have treatments. We have interventions. We have foundations now that are implementing them. SEAL Future Foundation, I think, has one of the best health programs for SEALs who are no longer active duty. And it's a peer-led program. You could call them. They'll talk to you for 2 or 3 hours or whatever it takes. They'll work with you to figure out what you might need. They'll make suggestions. And then they will make the referrals because they have a referral network now, and they'll pay for it. And I think more foundations are starting to work this way. SEAL Future Foundation has a 15 or 16 member health advisory committee that I chair now. And it represents pretty much all of the specialties. So we have pharmacy, neurology, occupational therapy, nutrition, advanced practice nurses. Chelsea Simone is on it. Gabrielle Lyon is on it. Kirk Parsley is on it. Sean Mulvaney. We have Rich Aukus, who is a Air Force veteran, who is one of the leading endocrinologists in the nation.
No kidding.
The University of Michigan.
You guys got a powerhouse of a.
It's a
advisory board.
Yeah, it's a fucking powerhouse. And what we've done together with the SEALs that run the health program is we've developed what we're calling an operator health index. So they're going to put it up on the website. It's probably 2 to 4 weeks away from being available, but it will be available to everybody in the world. It's going to be right there. And so you could, if you want to go, well, what's stellate ganglion block therapy? Right there. There'll be a short article about it. And then there will be links to other articles about it. If you want to learn, if you could flip it around the other way, if you go, well, what are the good treatments for anxiety? You could go to that and it will take, you'll see a number of things, including the stellate ganglion block therapy. So it's essentially a book that we've all written together that's going to live online, and we're going to update it as new information comes along. So it'll be a living document available to everybody.
That's, if you have no doubt, that took a lot of work to put together, and it's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So treatments. Wow, there's so many. So let's start with the obvious. You know, everybody knows psychotherapy and psychiatric medications are available. They are very, very important and very, very useful for many people. I'm not saying everybody needs psychiatric medications, but it's worth considering antidepressants. I think a lot of guys maybe would benefit from mood stabilizer, but that's one option. Psychotherapy, I think, can be very effective. The challenge is finding a therapist who knows what they're doing. How many therapists are educated and culturally competent in working with combatants?
Very few.
Very few. Very, very few. And we could go into have a whole long conversation about the VA and the problems with the VA. We probably don't have time for that today. That can be a separate podcast. Yeah. But so I'm a fan of psychotherapy if the therapist knows what they're doing and knows how to work with combatants and can function as a quarterback, as a coach for all the other treatments that exist. So one of the first things I often recommend is stellate ganglion block. That is a very simple, one-time medical procedure. It's been in medicine for 100 years, so it's not new. About a decade ago, couple of neurologists, including Sean Mulvaney, noticed that it actually, they were using it to treat soldiers' headaches and noticed that it also was a powerful treatment for anxiety. Stelic, one block treatment, which involves a needle into the side of the neck and injecting a little lidocaine into the sympathetic nervous system.
I remember his name way back, as far back as 2010, and guys yeah. getting that done. What they called it was like a reset.
Yeah,
where it's a reset. It reset your flight or fight.
Right. That's the sympathetic nervous yep. system is your fight or flight mechanism, which is a critically important survival mechanism. But a lot of guys are just like, they're high strung. It's just so overactivated when it doesn't need to be. This just turns it down and it does it immediately. So guys, like the next day, they're like, I feel different. Oh, I'm relaxed. And if you're relaxed, you're sleeping. Mm. If you're relaxed, you're a little less vigilant, hypervigilant, and you're more present with your family. So it's powerful. Great way to start because you get an immediate sense of efficacy there's help available. They're also now doing some clinical trials to look at the hypothesis of whether not only does it treat the anxiety, but does it help stimulate neurogenerativity. So as a treatment for TBI, it may help stimulate the growth of new neurons, dendrites, pathways in the brain. Ketamine infusion is another very powerful treatment that I'm a fan of. It's not for everybody. I'm not trying to say everybody should run out and do ketamine. And if you do ketamine, do the infusion. That means sitting in a comfortable chair for a couple of hours. They run the ketamine intravenously for maybe an hour, maybe 90 minutes, maybe less. And then they unplug you and you sit there till your head clears an hour or so and you go home. Four to eight of sessions like that are very good at treating a lot of the psychological issues. And we also think that it not only works symbiotically with stellate ganglion block, but that it also helps stimulate neurogenerativity.
No kidding.
So another treatment for brain health. The MERT, the TMS MERT version is phenomenal. And I work with a group that developed that. So we have a paper now we've sent out for review, journal review, just a chart review, but really good, really powerful.
What is MERT?
Magnetic, I forget what the rest of the words stand for, but it's okay. So let me start with transcranial magnetic stimulation is sitting in a chair for 20 minutes at a session. They position a coil next to your head, and think of it like a dental, you know, those x-ray things where they can position it anywhere. So they bring it, and you just sit there, and it buzzes a little electrical stimulation, magnetic electrical.
Which stimulates your brain.
Stimulation into the brain. What the MERT does, and it's M, little E, big R, big T. Wave Neuro is the group that has developed this and is now studying it. And they use an EEG reading to figure out the frequencies and the precision of the TMS. And this is a treatment that I think the Air Force is now looking at as a prophylactic mid-career treatment for their guys to help prevent the extreme brain injuries.
And that's great.
The data looks good. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy is promising, and the Israelis have knocked this out of the park, I think. I've been in some conversations with the Israeli team that does this. They are now, this clinic, this program in Israel is now routinely using hyperbaric oxygen therapy, HBOT, to treat PTSD and just PTSD with good effect, and also TBI. And they've just published in the last two years, they've published some great papers on it. So people that want to learn more.
I've heard for my guys who've done HBOT, I've heard amazing things actually where they took scans of the brain pre and post and some gray matter had almost completely healed.
Yeah. The data I would still say is still preliminary. Mm-hmm. Like we're still trying to figure it out, and it is very time consuming. because you got to go to like 60 sessions where you spend an hour to 90 minutes sitting in the dive tank. But again, that might be prophylactic too. And I don't know how much that has been studied, but if you put an operator into that environment, you know, every 5 years or so, once a week, I don't know. There's probably all kinds of ways to start looking at getting that dialed in.
And some of those dive chambers they have can sit multiple.
Yeah. Right. And you can read the newspaper, you can read a book, you could sit in there with your therapist and have your psychotherapy at the same time. Let's see, what else? Vestibular therapy for TBI. People don't really think of that. Speech pathology therapy for TBI. These are powerful treatments. Now, does the VA provide any of these? Not really. The VA is not. There are a few VAs in the country that might do stellate on a limited basis or might do ketamine on a limited basis. But in general, most veterans can't find these treatments through the VA yet.
I'm 3 years waiting for a replacement for my sleep apnea machine.
Are you serious?
Oh,
yeah.
VAs. And you know, there are some very good people in the VA. It's government. Don't get me started on government. So there's good people in the VA who want to do good things, but they're restricted by the...
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And there's so much crazy going on in the VA. That's the other problem. The VA has just gotten distracted with treating racial trauma, LGBTQ trauma, transition. You know, they're now doing a lot of surgeries.
I've said this. The VA needs to be reduced substantially. Their core function, college benefits, transition benefits. I think the VA needs to be privatized. That's my perfect.
Civilian transition benefits, not benefits to transition to another gender.
They need to move that medical over to the private side.
I would agree. Because
easy access, they just don't have the capability to serve our nation's veterans.
They're
too small. There's too much bureaucracy. It just, what about-
But Mike, they're not going to do that because they have this large federal workforce that can't be fired. And I mean, it's a great way of the more people you have working for the government, the bigger you get to be.
Don't get me started. And there mediocracy is the mantra when it comes to government workers.
Well, there's no accountability.
Okay. There's good people in government that are showing initiative,
for sure.
Entrepreneurial,
for sure.
But for a lot of government workers, they feel like they're entitled to their paycheck. It's like, what's the bare minimum I can do?
Yeah.
And that probably just offended a lot of people. And if you're a government worker and that offended you, it's probably because it's true.
Psychedelics?
Yeah, that's where I was going to go, because this is still, there's societal prejudices against psychedelics, but the amazing work that psychedelics have had on helping with PTSD and other.
Yeah. 4 years ago, I was contacted by Heroic Hearts, Jesse Gould's group. He's a former Ranger, and they kind of wanted me to get me involved. And I was just like, whoa, no way.
Mm-hmm.
Stay away. Take me out of this.
Controversial.
Yeah. Not just controversial, but I didn't think it worked. I don't care about controversy. I just didn't think it worked. I thought it was dangerous. I thought it was goofy. I thought it was just a bunch of smish, smash, hooey, you know? My opinion is completely different.
180.
Now. Way different. So I do work a little bit, you know, Jesse's a friend. He's on the back of the book. He's got a quote on the very back of the book. Heroic Hearts is phenomenal. Marcus Namber Capone with Vets, Inc. I'm on their board. Mission Within, Martin Polanco. Yes. All of these folks have quotes in the book.
God bless book. Martin Polanco and then Amber and... Why am I blanking? Marcus.
Marcus Capone.
They've helped so many...
They have moved the needle. They have moved the needle. And so, you know, as a scientist, I like to be scientific. I have to be scientific to the extent that I can. So there is this balancing thing of, we don't really fully understand some of these treatments. Let me rephrase that. We don't understand these treatments. We don't yet, you know, know the mechanism of action, why they work. We don't have good clinical trials yet for some of these. Compounds. I think psilocybin we do, and psilocybin will be mainstream medicine. I think it will get FDA approval in the next few years.
The amount of guys microdosing with psilocybin on a daily basis, one for mood regulation, and they even say, "I feel alert. I feel more alert. I'm happy."
We don't know much about microdosing. I don't think that's really been studied. much at all. But so then you end up with a couple of things. Well, guys are dying now. Guys are dying by suicide. The suicide rate is sky high. Most of the guys I talk to, they can name 7 to 10 guys, friends, brothers who have taken their life in the last few years. It's absolutely astonishing.
Chad Wilkinson, and Bobby Ramirez, Dave Hall. I mean, the list just goes and goes, and guys who you never thought would take their own
life. That's right.
Just suffering in silence.
Yep.
Battling something, and then all of a sudden, they're gone.
Yep. And it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. And nobody's aware of this because it's not studied.
It's just a number.
It's another
number that Americans can just look past. But
we don't even know what the number is because it's hard to get that, find that number.
Yeah, you've seen this. Even suicide on active duty has skyrocketed.
Yeah. Maybe we come back to suicide. But go back to psychedelics. So the research is now starting to happen. We are, I think all of us are trying to balance the need to help individuals now. And we're just seeing anecdotally the benefits are almost miraculous and they're sustained. I know so many guys that did it 2, 3, 4 years ago and they're like doing really well today. Like the benefits don't just disappear.
And that can happen in parallel.
And
give it to them now, not completely sure of the mechanism.
Right.
While doing the research in parallel.
Yes. There was a great study, Stanford just put out a study. It was an open trial, not randomized, but an open trial with just, pre-post numbers for ibogaine. And the data is just like, wow.
Overwhelming.
It's overwhelming on depression, PTSD symptoms, but the traumatic brain injury. Again, it's healing the brain. It's not just changing your awareness and connecting you to the spirit world. It's fucking changing the brain, healing the brain.
And you've seen, well, John Hopkins has been around. They've been doing a lot of testing. The University of Texas here in Austin stood up a psychedelic.
I've done a little center. Work with them through Martine and the Mission Within. And that study is underway. Probably more than one study, but the study I'm working on with them is underway. So yeah, there's phenomenal treatments. They're just hard to come by. They're hard to find. You got to go through the foundations.
And you got to go outside the United States for most of it.
And sometimes you got to go outside the United States. Oh, regenerative medicine.
Stem
cells, peptides, exomes, and some of that guys are going out of the country, but there are regenerative medicine clinics in the US.
They're just really expensive.
They're expensive, but there's foundations that will cover down on that.
CPI, which is a Cellular Performance Institute run by Ed Clay and Scotty Nelson, they just aligned with a foundation that will fund veterans to go get stem cell.
Yeah.
And it was phenomenal. Those guys run a boutique type service. It was concierge, if that's a better word.
Yeah.
Just concierge. Remarkable.
Yeah. The Joy Wellness Clinic in San Diego, which is actually Carol Bender is married to an active duty SEAL. And her clinic, and she's on the board of SEAL Future Foundation. And they based on location, they do a lot with Marines and Naval Special Warfare, but they take guys from all over the country. And there are foundations that are flying people there for treatment. Yeah. The LeMay clinic, Dr. LeMay's clinic in the panhandle of Florida, he has a whole team of people who have worked. Kevin Lace, who is a SEAL, who you may know. Brian Stepanenko was an Army physician who's now at that clinic. He was working at Fort Bragg treating, Tier 1 and soldiers and SF soldiers. So
my question is, why isn't that available to guys on active duty? Why wait until they're out to give them the options of regenerative medicine when, I don't know if it's like a prophylactic. Is there something with regenerative medicine that even if they don't have a knee problem, they can strengthen that these are the things.
These are good questions.
That may dull the impacts of the job as a whole once they're out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, hopefully we're now starting that conversation.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer.
Like taking a brain scan.
Yeah.
Day one of their special operations career. Because I remember I was told you have 50% cognitive degradation. You've seen my medical charts. Yeah. And I'm like, based off what? You never took a baseline. And they said, oh, well, your peers. I told you the story. I laughed. I'm like, I was never as smart as my peers. So, okay, continuing on.
Well, no, it's worse than that. A lot of times it's you have X percent change or you're in this range. You're not being compared to your peers in special forces, in special operations. You're being compared to your general population.
Of people that never saw
of everybody of,
impacts. Of, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
wrong demographic.
Wrong. Yeah. I mean, to compare, to say to you, Mike, and your brothers who, you know, in service, that your testosterone is quote normal because it's 301, which is within the normal population, normal range for general population is just laughable.
Yeah.
And why DOD and VA are not, waking up to this? I don't know. But I will put just, you know, kind of plant this seed. I think they have relied on PTSD as the easy button. You're suffering, your life is jacked up, PTSD, boom, hit that red button, and we send you down the hallway to the mental health
to
people.
To collect your pills.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, we're right at time. What do you want to leave with people about this book and how it may impact them? I know especially first responders, cops, firemen, ambulance drivers, or EMTs, of course, the special operations community, as well as the conventional military pilots. What do you want to leave them with? And then we'll let them know where they can find this book.
Yeah. So I wrote the book as my, you know, I wrote the book for the community. And I want to help the community, singular, understand the injuries so that they don't have to feel shame or embarrassment.
Yeah.
So that they don't have to wonder, I don't feel like myself, but I don't know what's going on. I want them to understand they're not necessarily going to get the help or the understanding that they need from organized modern medicine, which is very fragmented, by the way. You go to one doc, you get this treatment, but nobody's looking at the whole picture. I want them to understand the injuries, but I also want them to have the hope and understand there are treatments and lifestyle changes that can be made. I mean, there's profound healing and recovery out there to be found. You just have to go look for it and find it.
Well, guys, we are dropping the podcast the same day that this comes out, March 26th, 2024. I can't say enough on what you've done for my brothers and sisters in arms, not expecting anything in return. And so one of the ways that we can return it while still, you know, impacting more lives, because you can only talk to so many people on the phone so many days of the week, is pick this up. It should be mandatory reading, whether you're becoming a police officer, a fireman, you know, special operator, pilot, infantry. This arms you, not to sway you into a victim category, because I know Chris, and he definitely is as anti-victim category as I am, but what you've done and all the time you put into all of us to put it into a book, for my brothers and sisters in arms, thank you for what you've done, and thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, brother.
All right, guys. It's been another episode of the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. Hey, go to Amazon, go to Apple, go to Spotify, leave a review, please. Let us know what you think, how to improve. We actually read them all. All right, guys. Thanks.